Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yalke in Washington. Ahead, we'll report on high-level talks between Russian and Arab leaders. An analyst discusses division within Afghanistan's Taliban. We have reaction to Iran's reported turnover of information on past nuclear activity.
What this shows is that the Iranians are extremely serious about getting that deal signed up with the international community.
And we'll hear from the music library about a new CD from a British pop diva. It's ahead on The Voice of America. Russian President Vladimir Putin is taking advantage of a military exhibition in Moscow to discuss an Iranian-Russian initiative for ending the civil war in Syria with visiting Middle Eastern leaders. Jordan's King Abdullah and Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan of the United Arab Emirates arrived in Moscow on Monday, followed Tuesday by Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke to Mark Katz, professor of government and international relations at George Mason University, about the reasons behind the Arab reliance on Moscow. And Mohammed, welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
Say, three Arab leaders are visiting Moscow this week: El-Sisi of Egypt, Jordanian King Abdullah, and the UAE Crown Prince. What attracted these leaders to Russia?
Well, so they visit the same capital, but for different reasons. The only common thread is trying to explore ways to end the conflict in Syria as a crucial way to counter the rising threat of the Islamic State group. Also arriving in Moscow was a delegation representing the National Syrian Coalition, the internationally recognized umbrella organization of the Syrian opposition groups. Assad's opponents reject the idea of including him in the fight against the Islamic State, known as ISIS or ISIL, and they want to ensure that any future scenario includes his departure as well. However, Professor Katz argues that each leader has other agenda items in mind.
There's obviously specific issues with each country. I think, you know, there's an arms agreement possibly with Egypt, you know, the nuclear power agreements. But I also think that these visits are taking place, you know, within the aftermath of the signing of the Iranian nuclear accord, which several Arab governments are not very happy with. They don't like America moving. They see it as moving toward Iran, and perhaps there's sort of a reaction that they're hoping that somehow to move toward Russia. I also think that maybe there's a certain amount of hope that there could be some movement in the Syrian issue. On the other hand, we've seen that the Saudis and the Russians don't seem to be able to agree on whether Assad should stay or not.
According to the Kremlin, El-Sisi talks with Putin will focus on strengthening bilateral relations and closer ties with Moscow. But getting closer to Moscow is coming just a few weeks after the resumption of U.S.-Egyptian strategic cooperation and military aid.
Well, experts explain this as a bargaining card or chip that El-Sisi has used before to get the Obama administration to resume the suspended military aid, and apparently it did work. So Professor Katz has his own explanation.
Well, it may be that the Egyptians calculate that although the U.S. Is being a little more forthcoming, that maybe talking with the Russians is sort of an insurance policy to make sure that the Americans understand that Egypt has options.
The Egyptian president said also he is interested in trying to attract Russian business leaders to invest in Egypt. But according to Professor Katz, this is not feasible at a time when Russia is facing its own economic problems and Egypt is still lacking security and stability.
Well, thank you, Mohammed, for following this developing story for us.
Thank you for having me.
An internal power struggle apparently continues to plague Afghanistan's Taliban insurgency. On the line with us is Daniel Markey, an adjunct senior fellow for South Asia with the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome to our program.
Happy to join you.
Thank you. First of all, what is your assessment of what's going on with this division in the Taliban?
Well, it is clear that not all of the Taliban leadership have accepted Mullah Omar's successor, Mullah Mansour. But precisely what part of that leadership is unwilling to accept him and the consequences of that fracturing, whether it's likely to be a long-term split or the kind of short-term disagreements that we've seen in other parts of the Pakistani Taliban, for instance, when they've lost their leader, is at the moment unclear.
Mullah Abdul Manan, a brother of the late leader, Mullah Omar, spoke with VOA, and he said that the leadership crisis is the biggest issue facing the Taliban, and that the rivals should avoid confrontation until a decision by religious scholars. What is your reaction to that?
Well, it certainly is a big deal. I mean, one thing that we should all keep in mind is that apparently Mullah Omar died as long as 2 years ago. So one thing that's quite interesting is how this leadership succession issue has been kept under wraps for possibly as long as 2 years, maybe even longer. And that suggests that the number of people who are really in the know in that tight inner circle of Taliban has been kept very, very small. Now that he's clearly dead, that Mullah Omar is clearly dead, the number of Taliban who will think that they have a say in who should be his successor grows significantly, and probably exposes the kinds of frictions that reportedly had existed, for instance, between field commanders and those leaders who have been based inside of Pakistan or elsewhere. And those kinds of splits have been somewhat apparent over the years, but now they may be bursting out into the open.
Well, it's been so long. Does there need to be a new leader officially announced in public, or can they continue just as they're doing now?
No, there absolutely needs to be a new leader in order for the Taliban to be the kind of unified insurgent movement that it has been, to continue to wage a reasonably successful, especially in recent years, war against the Afghan state and NATO, even at lower levels of NATO. But there doesn't need to be a unified Taliban movement in order to have continued fighting within and throughout Afghanistan, and for the Afghan state to have trouble consolidating itself, especially as U.S. and NATO forces have dwindled to under 10,000. So you can see continued insecurity no matter what happens with the Taliban leadership, but in order for it to be an effective insurgent movement that can make claims on leadership of the country and negotiate and so on, you really do need to have this top leadership.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today. We certainly appreciate you taking time.
Thank you.
One way to keep up with the latest news on the Taliban is to do a search for hashtag Taliban on Twitter. Michael Lippin was looking into that earlier and joins me now in the studio. Hey, Michael, what have you found out on the Taliban today?
Hi, Susan. Well, hashtag Taliban has had about 2,000 mentions in the past day on Twitter. That's according to the Topsy Analytics website. One of those tweets that's getting some attention is an analysis piece by the U.S.-based research group Rand Corporation. Its handle is at Rand Corporation, and it tweeted a link to an article by Jeff Eggers, one of its senior fellows, who also is a former special assistant to the U.S. president on national security affairs. The Rand tweet says, "The Taliban's new leadership may be the last chance for a political solution in Afghanistan." Now, in the article, Eggers writes that Taliban chief Mullah Mansour has little incentive to make conciliatory peace overtures to the Afghan government while struggling to maintain the Taliban's unity. He also says Mansour's Taliban would be moderate compared to what the Islamic State would bring to Afghanistan. Eggers writes that the Taliban already are in conflict with the Islamic State, and that the Afghan government has at least some common interest with the Taliban in opposing the militant group. So he says that could be an opening for a political accommodation in Afghanistan. Susan?
Thank you, Michael, for that report. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Early in its history, the moon rocked with volcanism. Volcanoes blasted streams of magma high above the lunar surface in eruptions known as fire fountains. To power these explosive eruptions, the magma needs to mix with volatile chemicals and chemical compounds. In a study published by the journal Nature Geoscience, the researchers say the ancient lunar fire fountains were driven by considerable amounts of carbon dioxide gas. The researchers found that the lava from deep inside the moon was rich in carbon, and as it rose toward the lunar surface, mixed with oxygen to create the supply of CO2. To make their findings, the scientists carefully analyzed glass beads that had been brought back from the moon decades ago on the Apollo 15 and 17 missions. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The head of the UN Atomic Energy Agency says Iran has turned over substantive amounts of information on its past nuclear activity, but cautions it is too early to say whether any of the documents contain new information. My colleague Victor Beatty is following this story and joins us here in the studio. Victor, what's going on?
Hello, Susan. Well, Yukiya Amano, chief of the International Atomic Energy Agency, known as the IAEA, spoke with reporters Tuesday in Vienna.
Next step will be for us to study, review, and ask questions by the 15th of September. And then Iran and IAEA will engage in the substantiation process. At this stage, it is premature to say if there is any new information or not. We are now analyzing it. And we need to see the whole picture to have assessment.
Sanctions relief for Iran hinges on what the IAEA has to say about Iran's past and present nuclear efforts. Under a side agreement reached last month between Iran and the IAEA, the UN agency must complete its work by October 15 and present a final report by December 15. Details remain confidential. UN access to the military site at Parchin remains uncertain. Sharam Akbarzadeh is an Iranian analyst with Australia's Deakin University. He told me the documents turned over to the IAEA reflect Tehran's apparent willingness to cooperate in order to get sanctions relief.
What this shows is that the Iranians are extremely serious about getting that deal signed up with the international community. It is not certain, to my mind, how significant the relevance of military aspect is. It may be just old material that has been recycled.
Iran insists its program is peaceful, but apparently has limited UN inspectors to its sites.
Well, Iran has been reluctant, of course, to allow international inspections on its sites because Iran would see this and has always insisted that any inspection would have to be part of a package, and the package would have to include the removal of sanctions. So Iran has resisted inspections while sanctions are on. But the situation is very different now with the prospect of removing sanctions and Iranians' willingness to allow unprecedented access to its sites, which includes, I might add, some military sites.
Iran's envoy to the IAEA, Reza Najafi, declined to explain whether IAEA inspectors would be allowed to inspect Iran's Parchin military site south of Tehran, where some accuse the Islamic Republic of having conducted nuclear bomb-related experiments. Do you think that will be possible?
I think the Iranian officials would not want to make any promises either way about access to specific sites until they have the deal signed up by the Congress and by the Iranian Majlis. Any information that the Iranian officials would divulge at various media interviews would potentially be used by critics of the deal in the internal domestic debate to undermine and discredit the deal. So that explains largely why officials refrained from talking about that.
Akbarzadeh says the absence of any opposition to the nuclear deal by the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, tells him that the Iranian regime is prepared to rejoin the international community. But he says Tehran will not change its regional policies, such as its close relations with Hezbollah in Lebanon and militia groups in Iraq.
Thank you very much, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, we continue our series on migration to Europe. And Rita Ora has a new CD. The massive migration wave pressing into Europe is causing much concern, and so far, not enough discussion among European Union leaders, some say. International Edition's Jeffrey Young continues to focus on this story this week. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Hi, Susan.
Jeff, who are you talking to today about this problem?
I've spoken with Angelos Chrysogelos, a fellow with the European program at the research organization Chatham House in London. He told me about the present lack of a clear EU policy to deal with this migration wave and also nationalist pressures within these countries demanding that the borders be sealed.
The EU does not have a centralized government-like approach to migration. It's really about coordinating the needs and the priorities of many different member states. Different EU member states face different pressures from this migration problem. So the challenge for the EU is to come to bring all those different member states together around a table and come up with a common solution that will have to be agreed upon by all those member states.
We have a problem in a number of the European countries with nationalist elements, people within the countries that say, no, lock the door, bolt it shut, causing a problem in reaching a resolution by the EU on this migration crisis.
Yeah, that's a critical dimension. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to think about it because we're talking about human beings here, but the attitude in various member states really is not in my backyard. And this has been quite evident in the effort by the European Commission some months ago to institute a voluntary relocation scheme for a number of refugees within European countries. You see some European countries, such as Greece or Italy, facing immense first wave pressures. These are the countries where migrants land at first, and it creates enormous pressures on those countries. And we're talking about Greece and Italy. These are also countries in the Eurozone South, which means that there are countries that institute austerity, and there are these are countries that already see the rise of nationalist parties that are also fed by the economic crisis, and the migration further strengthens that. Then you see more affluent countries, such as Germany and the Netherlands. These are the countries where migrants eventually want to go to, or the UK. And there you have radical right parties that have always been anti-migration.
That was Angelos Chrysogelos, a fellow with the Europe Program at Chatham House, a research organization based in London.
Thanks for staying on top of this story for us in all its dimensions.
Susan, this massive migration wave demands that we pay attention.
This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
A new study suggests that getting regular exercise early in life may be important for adult health. Researchers at Vanderbilt University, using data from the Shanghai Women's Health Study, say they found that women who had exercised for more than 80 minutes per week as adolescents or participated in team sports had a lower risk of cancer and heart disease. The researchers say they believe the findings likely apply to boys as well. Meanwhile, in a new study by the American Cancer Society, researchers say they find that adult women who spend 6 hours or more sitting every day have a greater risk of multiple myeloma, ovarian, and breast cancer than women who sit for 3 hours or less. The data is drawn from a study of 77,000 women followed for 15 years. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
British pop diva Rita Ora has a new CD coming out and a new song featuring Chris Brown. My International Edition colleague David Byrd spoke with VOA Border Crossings host Larry London about the new CD and the new song, Body on Me.
Maybe you know her from The X Factor in Britain. Maybe you know her from her Oscar-nominated performance. But Rita Ora is lighting up the pop charts with her new song and her new record. Larry, Rita is, she's got a long list of accomplishments.
Oh, yeah.
Not just pop music.
She's pretty hot right now, with, of course, judging on the TV show and endorsing all of these very well-known name brands throughout the UK. She's had, believe it or not, 6 top 5 hits. And of those, she's had 4 number ones in the UK. And she currently recorded a brand new duet with Chris Brown. The video came out this week. Her tour started in the US this week. So she's been very, very busy here in America.
Now, this is, did she write this song that we're talking about, or did she, is this a written by somebody else and she's just singing it?
Well, it was, I don't know who wrote it, but the song is directed by Colin Tilley, who has worked with Justin Timberlake and Kendrick Lamar, the video, and the song will appear on her upcoming new album. It doesn't say anywhere whether she wrote it or co-wrote it or had anything to do. She's not known for her writing skills. But she, of course, was nominated for a Billboard Award, Grammy Award with Iggy Azalea for Black Widow.
I love you like a Black Widow, baby. I'm a Black Widow, baby. Black Widow, baby. I'm a Black Widow, baby. Black Widow, baby.
A song from a year ago, and she's making a splash here in America. She's well-established in the U.K., but she's trying to get that same traction here in the U.S.
And now fans also, she's not hard to look at.
Not at
all.
She's
a very attractive young woman. And she's got a tour going on. Where are some of the stops on her tour?
Well, the tour begins this week here in the United States, San Francisco, Los Angeles, then Santa Ana, California, Las Vegas, Atlanta, Georgia, Boston, Massachusetts, here in Washington, D.C. in the middle of September, and hopefully I'll get her on border crossings.
Well, that'd be great. That'd be fantastic. Well, if you have any comments about Rita Ora's latest single, the title of which is?
It's Body on Me.
The title of it is Body on Me. If you have any comments about that, you can send us a tweet. We're at VOAIE. You can also listen for Larry's program, Border Crossings, on our website. That's www.voanews.com.
Baby, let's cut down the lights. I just really want to let this fire burn bright. I'm just telling you to have an own. Just imagine us.
Thanks for joining us for International Edition.
All is barely touching. So do it again, so do it again. We could be on for something. Hey, oh, hey, oh. I just wanna feel your body on me. Hey, oh, hey, oh. If you want.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On August 18th, 82-year-old Khaled al-Assad, a prominent Syrian archaeologist and the head of antiquities for the ancient city of Palmyra for more than 40 years, was brutally murdered by the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL. In May 2015, ISIL seized control of Tadmor, which contains the historic ruins of the ancient city of Palmyra. Despite the danger that prevailed with ISIL's previous murderous acts and destruction of other cultural heritage sites, al-Assad remained in the city to protect its treasures and helped evacuate the city museum prior to ISIL's takeover. The United States condemns in the strongest possible terms this murder of a man who dedicated his life to preserving Syria's cultural treasures, said U.S. State Department spokesperson John Kirby. Like so many of ISIL's victims, his life and extraordinary work stand in stark contrast to that of his barbaric killers, he said. These attempts to erase Syria's rich history will ultimately fail. ISIL's damage and looting of historic sites in Syria and Iraq, which have been preserved for millennia, have not only destroyed irreplaceable evidence of ancient life and society, but have also helped fund its reign of terror inside those countries. Mr. Kirby said, as we respond to the brutality and suffering ISIL inflicts on the Syrian and Iraqi people, we continue to urge all parties in both countries and in the international community to deprive ISIL of this funding stream by rejecting the trafficking and sale of looted artifacts. All those who destroy important cultural property must be held accountable.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.